There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.
Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Joyce Vance, Kimberly Atkins-Store, Barb McQuaid, and me, Jill Wine Banks. The gift-giving season is here, so don't forget to check out our merch store. We restocked everything in time for the holidays. Just go to politicon.com/merch. Now, let's get on to the show where we're going to have some really good discussions today. First, we're going to talk about some unique issues concerning the capture and status of Luigi Mangione, the alleged killer of the United Healthcare CEO. We have some really interesting topics talking about clemency and pardons. And then we're going to talk about, will justice be done at DOJ in the new civil rights division under the new chief, about FBI under Kash Patel and Ray resigning? And what does the DOJ IG report mean? Before we get to our topics, I want to ask you all, have you put up any holiday decorations or made any special preparations for the coming holidays? Christmas and Hanukkah fall on the same day this year.
Well, as I sit here in front of my tree, which I have put up, podcast room, I always put up an artificial tree. And in our living room, we have a live tree that we're waiting for my stepson, who's on his way home, to trim. So yeah, we've begun. Greg's hung lights. Yeah, we are in progress with our decorations. They're not done, but we have begun. I have to say, I have been feeling not jolly, like not jolly at all. And one of the things that I thought would help as I sort of forced myself. I really wasn't in the Christmassy mood, and you got to be in the mood to decorate and do all that stuff. So I kind of did it anyway, and it kind of worked. Like it, in itself, putting on some Christmas music, putting up some lights and things around the house, hanging mistletoe, actually did lift my mood. So it's important stuff.
You know, I'm all decorated too. It's like really early for me, just usually because of the nature of the beast. I don't get it done in time, but we have a tree up. It's a tinsel tree. And let me tell y'all the best thing about it. Instead of a tree skirt, I couldn't find my tree skirt. So I got on Amazon this pink fuzzy cat tunnel. And I think it's made to go around a tree or to go around something, because you actually take it around and then there's a hole in front and the cats go in it. And we were afraid the cats wouldn't find it. So I went outside and picked our last batch of catnip, threw it all through this tunnel. And
wait, so you want the cats at your tree? Like, I would think it would be the other way around. You want to keep the cats away from the tree.
Here's what I don't want. I don't want the cats up the tree, because you know, like the stereotype cartoon about the cats going up the tree and knocking it over.
That's been a diversion.
This is like it's like a little tunnel around. I'll take a picture.
It's like a tree moat.
Send it to y'all. In fact, I have a picture on Instagram.
Does it have a drawbridge?
You know, they go inside. And I mean, theoretically, it could be bad if there's more than one of them in there at a time. But y'all, I am very taken with it. You know, I like green trees. Bob likes tinsel trees. We're doing it his way this year. So I figured if we were going to be tacky, we were going to go all in for tacky. And pink fur for the cats it is.
I want that in our show notes, the link to that picture.
I'll send a picture.
And Barb, what about you?
Well, last weekend, my husband and I went to the Christmas tree farm where we always go to get our Christmas tree. And, you know, this year, no kids. They're all off kind of doing their own thing. So it was just the two of us. And as we're walking in really deep snow, I said, do you remember that time a couple years ago when our daughter lost her phone in the snow and we spent just hours looking for it? And we kind of laughed and we rolled our eyes. And then I said, oh my gosh, where's my phone? I had done the same thing. I had taken a picture when we got there, so I knew I had it, and then I didn't anymore. And we looked around, and there was knee-deep snow everywhere. And so, to my husband's credit, he did dig it up and retrieve it. We retraced our steps several times and found it buried, you know. And of course, we'd walked between like six or seven different trees, examining them, looking for the perfect tree. So it took some amount of time. So now when we tell the story of the lost phone of our daughter, it is also the lost phone of mom. So both of us fell into that category.
Gosh. So how hard did she laugh when she found out?
Well, she hasn't yet, and let's hope she doesn't listen to this podcast because I'll never live it down. Don't tell. Luckily, it's just the four of us. Don't tell
right.
anybody.
Oh, my God.
So I have a lost in the snow story, but it wasn't my phone. It was the stone from my engagement ring, which was my mother-in-law's. And so it wasn't, I mean, it was insured. I wasn't worried, but I was really upset because it was my mother-in-law's and my husband was very close to her. And I had to retrace my steps through the snow, which had all these salts in it. And every crystal salt looks like a diamond.
Oh, yeah.
It does.
Sparkling.
Yeah. And I was picking and picking, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I was devastated. I reported it to the insurance company. And a week later, I went back to the store that we had been in, and a ray of light came through the window.
No way.
And there it was. I picked it up, and I couldn't even speak. I found it.
It's a Christmas miracle.
It was. It was.
Amazing.
So, I mean,
wow.
As to decorating, I don't really decorate. I mean, I put out a menorah. But this year, I was having a party at my house for friends who do celebrate Christmas. So I bought a little metal teeny tree at my local jewel store. And that was, you know, everybody put their gifts under my little teeny tree, which meant on the floor because it's on the table. It's so small.
You know, it is worth noting, this is the rare Chrismica holiday, right? I
yes,
always
have
Chrismica for Christmas
it's like
Eve
the holiday
dinner.
Jackpot. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I get to make latkes this year for Christmas Eve. I'm so jazzed.
Oh, yum, yum, yum. Oh,
what
that
did you call
so
it?
Chrismica.
Chrismica. I like it. And in case our listeners don't know, that means Christmas and Hanukkah landing on the same day.
Yes.
Chrismica. I love it.
But happy holidays to everyone.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
This week, police arrested 26-year-old Luigi Mangione as a suspect in the assassination of an insurance company CEO outside the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. He was found eating at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania. At the time, he had a gun and a notebook with writing in it about the need to whack the CEO. He's been charged with murder in New York, and now he's facing extradition. And I thought it might be useful to just explain what extradition is. Jill, can you help us understand what extradition is? I mean, he isn't in another country. He's just in a neighboring state. Why can't the police just like throw him in the back of a car and drive him to New York?
I'm so glad you asked that question because it really is interesting how little is understood. Extradition is actually in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It is one of the parts of Article 4 of our Constitution, and There's also some federal laws about the process for extradition. Let me just say, before I talk about extradition between states, there is also extradition into and out of foreign countries, but that's under treaties. That has nothing to do with our Constitution. So it's completely separate. And the reason for extradition is to make sure that fugitives from the law in state one can't flee to another state and just escape, because you can cross state borders without any problems. And we don't want havens of criminality to be in a state because they didn't commit a crime in that state. Now, of course, in the case of Luigi, he did commit crimes in Pennsylvania, so he has been charged in Pennsylvania. But of course, the major crime, the murder, is alleged, he's alleged to have murdered someone in New York, and so New York wants him back. Under our laws, the Constitution and the federal laws, he has to be charged with a crime in a state. Now, it doesn't have to be a formal indictment. It could be an affidavit that lays out the evidence, which in this case, of course, is pretty clear. You mentioned that he had a gun. It's not just a gun. It's a gun like the gun that was used in the murder in New York. He had the writings that gave him motive. There's a lot of evidence, DNA and fingerprints that have now been found. So there's a lot of evidence that would support extraditing him.
So Joyce, why do you suppose Mangione is fighting extradition? It seems, you know, the question at extradition, of course, as Jill just explained, is not whether you're guilty or not guilty of the charges, just whether you're the person who's being sought in this prosecution. I mean, it seems like he's the person who's charged in New York. Why not concede the extradition and save your arguments for the substance of the charges themselves?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different reasons people do this. You know, in most cases, people will concede and will go to the district that they've been charged in to fight the case. But sometimes people want to stand on extradition. And I bet we all may have slightly different thoughts about why he's doing this. I'll tell you what mine is, and this is not necessarily an informed view, but sort of an instinctual one. My sense is that he is someone who has a platform and who has an agenda that he wants to push, and he will take advantage of every opportunity in court to share his views. And so in a hearing where he's fighting extradition, although that's not the issue, he will have the opportunity to speak and address. He is smart enough to understand that it will be a courtroom full of the press and that it will be yet one more opportunity for expanding his platform and getting his views out in public.
Especially that's given the folk hero status that this dude is getting, that it would be beneficial to sort of push this narrative. Maybe it could influence jury pool. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why to a lawyer, a defense attorney, might take this tack.
I agree with everything, but also having been a defense lawyer as well as a prosecutor, I would say delay is one of the reasons that this is happening. And polluting the fact pattern by saying there isn't sufficient evidence to do this, which is, of course, absurd. The evidence is overwhelming that this is the person who committed this crime in New York. And so I think it is partly all the reasons that you've said, Kim, but also it's just for delay. And I agree, Joyce, completely. It's for attention and for getting his message out. And we shouldn't let that happen.
You all raise two really interesting concepts about this case. One is this folk hero thing, which I find deeply disturbing, that there are people kind of cheering him on and selling products using the words he wrote on bullets and things like that. It is such a gross disregard for the value of human life. I find that really disgusting. The other thing about him, I suppose, is you know, there are people of color, there are people less prominent who get killed or disappear or charged with crimes every day. And they don't get the kind of attention that we've given to the death of the CEO and the hunt for, you know, Luigi Mangione. And now that he's like this wealthy guy, it seems like there is a, he's kind of one of those anti-hero kind of guys. And I think to the extent you raise this idea that a high profile might get him a chance to exploit that, I think is really troubling. Well, Kim, let me ask you about that. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just to that point. I bet if you ask people the name of the executive and the name of the shooter, they would only know one.
Yeah.
And that's
absolutely. And that's not the executive. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one reason I'm really frustrated with my profession this week. But go ahead, Barb. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I really just wanted to tee you up to talk about that because, you know, his defense attorney seems to be all over the media. In addition to fighting at every stage, you know, as Jill said, he said, oh, this evidence seems very weak to me. Like, really? Mm-hmm. But he's all over the media. And I'm wondering, you know, I always wonder why defense attorneys go in the media to defend their clients and whether that helps or hurts their cases. But is there anything unique about this case, about this particular defendant, about the attention that it's been getting, that makes this a particularly attractive case to try in the media?
Yeah. I mean, I think for all the reasons we were talking about as to why the defense attorney was taking the approach that he was, the use of the media is a part of that, right? You use the media to try to influence the public, to try to use the fact that he is a hero to his advantage. People that, you know, for better or worse, can make a big difference. If there are people, you know, shouting "Free Luigi," then that's going to create a different pall on this case than if it is framed as the brutal, brutal murder of Brian Thompson. I'm not even sure we said it yet. Brian Thompson is the person who was murdered in the street. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, but this isn't new. I mean, we had, you know, the OJ trial and other trials that use public and the media as a key part of their strategy, and it often works.
Yeah. Shame on us, right? We love the shiny object.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about two other issues that I think are really interesting in this case. One is surveillance cameras and the other is ghost guns. These are both kind of issues of some controversy and both play a prominent role in this case. Mangione was caught because a McDonald's customer and employee recognized him from the photos that were put out in the media. I mean, it was hard to miss. I saw all those photos. I'm sure you all did too. They were out there for several days. And Jill, I want to ask you what factors police consider when they're deciding whether to put suspect photos out into the public, right? Because there are some pros and cons of doing that.
There certainly are. And sometimes you don't want to do it because you don't want the suspect to know that you know exactly what he looks like and who he is and to have him take evasive action. So you might not want to post it. And he might flee if he knew that, of course, he had already fled, as it turns out, but fleeing is a result of making it known. On the other hand, you get the advantage of what happened here. People see him, and the pictures were quite clear. I mean, he was very recognizable, and now that we've seen him full face in his photos, he does look exactly like the person who was photographed on all the surveillance cameras. And it's certainly a reminder to all of us. Someone on TV said, boy, this shows that I better dress better and act better in public because you're on camera a lot.
Yes, yes, right? And when people go back, they can find, you know, people all over the place at protests and other places.
Right.
Joyce, this reminds me a little bit of the situation our friend Carmen Ortiz, the former U.S. attorney in Boston, dealt with when the Boston Marathon bombing occurred. And I know she's spoken publicly about that decision about whether to publish these photos. And I think initially they published some photos of the wrong person, which can cause a lot of grief for that person. Ultimately, they did put up the two bombers, the Tsarnaev brothers, and they got lots of calls. People said, oh my gosh, I know that guy. He lives in my dorm. He lives down the hall from me. And it made me wonder when we had this really clear picture of Mangione right away, that photo where he had pulled down the mask at the hostel. People said he was flirting with some woman who worked there and he was caught on a surveillance camera. Why did we have to wait several days later for someone at McDonald's to recognize him? Why didn't friends and family members and schoolmates say, oh my gosh, I know this guy. Is it surprising that they didn't turn him in, or is it possible that they did and we just don't know that yet?
You know, it's a pretty interesting question. For one thing, there was reporting that said that his name had not surfaced in tips, but we don't know for certain that that's true. And I would just caution and say I've been involved in manhunt situations before. You get a lot of tips on the tip line. Sometimes you do find that people have called in. So we don't know that. We don't know whether or not his appearance had altered. He'd been off the grid for about 6 months, according to the reporting. That may also have caused some drag on it. But, you know, his family may well have recognized him and had been taking some time to process it. I think the short answer is that we do not know what the thinking was. So you had sort of raised this question with Carmen's situation where they did post pictures. And there's always this question of what is our obligation as citizens? Are we required to call the police? We're not. I don't think the law requires that. I think, you know, many good citizens would and will do that, particularly in a situation like this where you have seen what is clearly a premeditated, deliberate murder. The suspect is still at large. You don't know if he has a longer list of people that he intends to attack. But it's not a crime. There is, interestingly enough, a crime called misprison, which could fit the bill here. And this is how I think about it. Forgive me. I'm going to try to do, you know, like the first 2 weeks of law school in 10 seconds right now. there is accomplice liability. If I rob the bank and somebody helps me, they're my aider and abettor. If after I've robbed the bank, the police are chasing me and I need somebody to hide me and I go to a friend's house and I say, I've robbed the bank, hide me. You know, she's an accessory after the fact. And then there's this concept of misprison, somebody who knows that a crime has been committed but takes an affirmative step to conceal it. I don't think that just failing to make a phone call qualifies as trying to conceal it. There's an old 11th Circuit case called Brantley where a woman is in the car with her boyfriend during a routine traffic stop. He shoots a police officer. It's just a weird surprise thing, no advance planning. And she is successfully prosecuted for misprison, not for the murder, but over his illegal possession of a firearm because he was a felon. And the whole reasoning is she backs her car in to conceal the license plate to make it harder for the police to find it. And the 11th Circuit, there's a concurrence written by one of the judges, and she says, okay, government, this is absolutely as far as you can go with this crime. No further. And that, for me, has always been sort of the defining thing. Just failing to make a phone call, I don't think, is an affirmative act of concealment.
And listen, I think there's also a point that can be made here. I mean, I think if there were a situation where there was a big manhunt, we knew this crime took place, and all of a sudden, a picture, a grainy picture from surveillance is released by police, I'm thinking to myself, what if it were my family member? I would have a lot of freaking questions. I don't think the first thing I would do, I know for a fact, the first thing that I did would not be picking up the phone and calling the police. I would contact that person. If I can get in touch with them, I would contact legal counsel just to figure out what's what. Could this picture be wrong? Could this be, I mean, I'm not going to send the family right to the cops. Like if, I don't know.
I mean, really don't know. The picture is, as you say, some of them are okay. Some are grainy, but is it 100% identification? You're not positive. At a minimum, you don't have an obligation under the law to make that phone call.
And you have to, I mean, and even when the police are using this, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe the prosecutors can speak more to this, but I'm assuming that there is some balance of some balance of factors, right? Because if you are releasing a picture to someone to the public, not only could that spur leads, but it could also spur a different kind of vigilantism. It could also put them more in danger. It could be, and police are not allowed to use just, in most jurisdictions, to use just the picture of someone as probable cause. So they have to have other investigations, other facts, even before an arrest can take place. So I do get that sometimes it's important. I agree that the Tsarnaev brothers should have been released. I agree with this one, with the information that I know, but just it's so much goes into this and it can be a dangerous thing to do too.
You raise an interesting set of issues, Kim, and it is definitely a balance because you want the public to be aware. This is, you know, someone who looked on camera like it was a planned, premeditated murder. And we didn't know if there were other people, as you said, on the list. And so you may want to warn people that this could happen. And so you want them to be aware of the picture. That's one reason. You don't want that person fleeing or destroying evidence by knowing that you've identified him. The family, you know, even if they reported that this is Luigi, that doesn't give the police any more information unless they know where he is. Right. And as Joyce said, it's clearly not a legal obligation to report it. But it is. It does come down to balancing, A, whether you print the picture, B, whether someone reports it. And I think that it certainly in this case was a way to capture someone who was wanted. He looked like it when he was arrested. He had a gun that looked like the gun that was used. He had a notebook that set out certain things. He had a computer that had evidence on it. So in this case, I think the balance was used in the right way.
Me too.
Well, I know you all said there's no legal obligation to report and you would hesitate to report a friend or family member, but bad news for you three. If I see your picture on a surveillance photo that you committed to crime, like I'm calling immediately and say, I know who they are and I know where they are.
But you know, Barb, what's going to happen is people are going to see a picture of me robbing the bank and they're going to go, oh my God, true. Barb McQuaid robbed the bank.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It'll turn right back around on me.
And I mean, isn't that the whole problem with identification?
Got me again, Vance. Right. All right. Well, I agree with everything that Joyce just said, except her pronunciation. And here in the North, we say Miss Prison, not Miss Prison, but everything else is good.
Prision.
No, in Miss Prison. I say Miss Prison, and I'm in the Midwest.
Look it up. ZH, Miss Prison. Mm. All right. Well, you can be known as Miss Prison forevermore, Joyce.
We'll get you a little sash.
It's like, you know, we did that to my daughter 1 year for Halloween. She was misinformation.
Oh, my kids call me that too.
Ooh, it's a good costume for you, Barb.
No, yeah, it is. I know. I would go as myself. All right. Well, Kim, let me get back to maybe a bigger point about surveillance cameras. Like, what does this say about the surveillance state? You know, on the one hand, the growing number of cameras that abound in public places cause concerns about civil liberties, especially when photos can be shared online. Like, if you go to a protest, chances are people are going to know that you were there. So there's no anonymity anymore. On the other hand, the photos taken with the security cameras in this case is what allowed those McDonald's customer and employee to recognize him. Does this make a strong case in favor of or against surveillance cameras in public, do you think?
I'm not sure if it's for or against. I do believe we are overly surveilled, but I understand the reasons why people may have surveillance on their homes or you know, outside of their businesses. But what I really believe is that police, law enforcement, the legal community has to be very... have to work really, really hard to enforce all of the constitutional protections that exist, whether these cameras are picking up your image or not. And also take into account the fact, I mean, when I was a fellow at Boston College Law this spring, my focus was on problems with AI and problems with facial recognition technology and how it tends to misidentify people. It more often, if you're a woman, you're more misidentified than if you're a man. If you are a person of color, you are more misidentified than if you are white. And if you are trans, you are more identified. I think that's probably the worst case matching. And so if people are using this as a police tool, I really, really want to make sure every Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment I is dotted and T is crossed, that other corroborating evidence is needed before probable cause is established, that you get warrant requirements before you do these kind of checks. If all of the safeguards are in place, yeah, it can be a good tool. But I think the fact that we know that they're not can make this very dangerous, even if it can be a tool to help find a mass killer on the loose.
Yeah, such an interesting issue. And as technology advances, you know, just because we can do things doesn't always mean we should. It's a really interesting issue. Well, let's quickly cover ghost guns, because I also think that's a super interesting issue in this case. Mangione was caught with what is known as a ghost gun. Jill, can you just remind us what a ghost gun is?
It's really interesting because A ghost gun is simply one that is assembled at home, usually from parts that have been bought online without a background check, and those parts don't have serial numbers. So it means that you can't follow it. You can't find it. You can't identify it. It has become quite popular. It was first invented, I think, in the 90s, but the number of guns that are now ghost guns have risen dramatically.
Yeah, so it's worth, you know, dwelling on this point that this was, it's believed that the gun was 3D printed. And that's very unusual. You almost never see that when you collect a gun from a crime scene. So the part of the frame that's extruded in the 3D printer is the frame. The frame is the part of the firearm that ATF regulates. And the other parts of the gun, the barrel, the trigger, those are just added on with aftermarket parts. In fact, you know, the case I know you want to ask him about in a minute, the Solicitor General, when she was arguing, mentioned that she had purchased a gun kit. And as someone with no particular dexterity, she had been able to assemble it in under 3 hours. So that gives you some sense of how quick and easy this stuff is. The reason people use them, two different reasons. One is if you're a prohibited person, for instance, a convicted felon who's not permitted to own or purchase a firearm, this is one way of getting a gun. Second reason is if you intend to use it to commit a crime because they are not traceable, because that frame that you've 3D printed has no tracing marks. ATF can't figure out the history of the gun, where you acquired it from, if there were other people involved. It is really a huge problem for enforcement to have these guns available. To find this one in this situation, I think, is deeply disturbing.
Yeah, and Kim, just this fall, in October, I think it was, the Supreme Court heard that case about ghost guns. We talked about it back then and the way ATF regulates them. Can you remind us what that case is about? And do you think this case could have any influence on the court in deciding that case?
Yeah, so this case was a challenge to a regulation, a Biden administration regulation, which counts ghost guns as any other kind of firearm, basically declares by regulation that a ghost gun is a gun for federal regulatory purposes. And the challengers were saying, well, no, you can't go regulating, you know, disassembled parts of a gun. Like, that's what, you know, what about the enthusiasts who enjoy putting guns together? Suddenly they have to go through all the, you know, rigmarole, and it will deter them and all this other stuff. Even this very, very Second Amendment loving Supreme Court did not seem to be buying that. Like, I think it was Amy Coney Barrett. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, you're right.
Look at it.
You're right.
Who was just like, if you love guns to the point that you are want to tinker with it and put together some, you don't want to get one where it's literally two screws and a click and the gun is done. Like, that's not, like, what enjoyment are you getting out of that? And really reinforcing Joyce's point that really the only reason someone buys one of these is a bad one. So yeah, I don't think the Supreme Court is going to buy that. I think these will be regulated, even if the Biden executive order is rescinded, or the regulation is rescinded. It was a regulation, not an exec order. There are a lot of states that already ban ghost guns. I think I just saw a headline today. Michigan just banned ghost guns. So, you know, states are banning them, and I think those regulations will and should stand. I would be up for also adding an enhancement for any crime committed with a ghost gun. I mean, I think that would be strong policy.
That is such a great idea. I have not heard that suggested before. Maybe it has been, but y'all heard it here. It's the Kimberly Atkins Store Amendment providing for enhanced penalties for use of a ghost gun. I think that's long overdue. Congress, pay attention.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Well,
Well, President Biden never promised you a rose garden, but he did promise more clemency. And now coming after he issues the broadest grant of pardons and commutations in one day in history, I want to ask you guys about it. Barb, who did Biden grant clemency to? And what do you think of the list? It's a long list.
Yeah, he granted clemency to nonviolent offenders who were released during the COVID pandemic and have behaved themselves since then and is not making them return. You know, at first blush, that probably sounds okay, but I've actually recognized several names on the list. And I don't like this use of clemency because they're not violent offenders, but they are serious offenders. There are people who committed healthcare fraud, public corruption, investor fraud, I mean, and really high numbers. And they got lengthy sentences, not because they presented a danger to the public, but as a deterrent to other people from committing these kinds of crimes. You know, these are rich people crimes. Mm. I mean, by that, I mean crimes committed by rich people or people in positions of power, as opposed to, you know, people who got caught up in a system who didn't have a lot of good alternatives in life, a lot of good choices. You know, when we were in the U.S. Attorney's offices, Joyce and I, President Obama had a clemency program where he granted clemency to nonviolent, lower-level drug offenders who kind of got caught up in the quantity of drugs being trafficked in an organization. And they themselves were not violent, but they had faced these very stiff mandatory minimum sentences who, if sentenced under current standards, would have received very much lower sentences. And so that struck me as a fairness issue where those were fine. And we were very proactive in finding people who met that definition. But here, you know, these are people whose crimes are based not on need, but on greed. And just because they're not violent to me doesn't mean they're not people who are deserving of lengthy prison sentences. So there's so many other people I find far more worthy of clemency that these, you know, the rich people who committed rich people crimes are like the least deserving people in my view.
Yeah. Can I just add something on to it? I don't disagree with anything that you've said, Barb. This disparity in sentencing used to always drive me crazy. You know, where you'd see a kid who got caught up in selling a small quantity of drugs get whacked with a long sentence. And these guys who just committed egregious white collar crimes would really get a slap on the wrist in many cases. I do think, though, that in our criminal justice system, we incarcerate far too many people for far too long. And although this might not be the place where I would personally want to start with fixing that problem, I do think we have to fix that problem. And one of the things that I really resent about Donald Trump and that I hold against him in my heart is that we were on the path to doing significant criminal justice reform. And that all got knocked off the table because we've been fighting for democracy for the last 8 years of our lives while people have been suffering in prison. So I have that off my chest. Sorry.
Well,
about
Joyce,
that.
Okay, so while you're talking, though, what do you think, what message do you think that Biden's trying to send here with this? I mean, you do have people who are not necessarily the poster boy for criminal justice reform. What do you think he's doing here?
I think I have actually some very good insight into this because I used to sit on an interagency working group where we talked about early release and principles like this. So during COVID, people who, for various reasons, were good candidates for release, elderly, in poor health, nonviolent, stuff like that, those people got paroled for home release. In other words, they weren't completely free. They had to act like they were under house arrest. And these commutations came for people who succeeded. Very few people reoffended after they got this release. And that was the experience with what Barb was talking about with the crack resentencings too. People who you give a second chance to, they're like, oh my gosh, they're so grateful. They reconnect with their families, their communities, they get jobs, they take advantage of resources, they succeed. There's good data that says that this community-based release really works. Well, these people had already succeeded. And so they were, in my mind, a good place for Biden to start. I hear the criticism. I don't disagree with it. I think as long as this is the first step and not the last step, it'll be a good thing.
Amen. So I agree with Joyce completely, except there are, as Barr points out, at least specific people when you do such a broad category who, I mean, he's Biden has been criticized. Two people from Illinois fall into the category Barb specifically mentioned. One was the comptroller of a small city who embezzled a lot of money from the city. And another was a fraudster who cheated investors out of $500 million. And so do they deserve different consideration just because they were released because of the coincidence of COVID? They were out of jail, but they were in home confinement and they were doing well. So if we're going to do that, then shouldn't we look at people who are now in jail, but who would do well in a home confinement or in being commuted?
Yeah, we should.
So I think that's the point. Yeah. Do a lot more of it, right? But we are better off as a community when we don't lock people up in prison because the reality is...
Well, let me ask you this, Jill. Let me ask you this. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over, but what do you think about folks who say, well, next, Biden should target everybody who Trump is talking about prosecuting. Do you think that's a good idea?
So, well, there's a lot to be said on this. And I agree with everybody that criminal justice reform is what's needed in general so that we don't over-sentence and over-incarcerate. And I also want to point out that although this is being hailed as the largest single release, I don't know why everybody's missing that 40 to 70,000 draft dodgers were pardoned by President Carter. Certainly a bigger release. But in terms of the preemptive, there are pros and there are cons. And there's a lot of argument both ways. When I first thought about it, was 100% in favor of preemptive. It shouldn't be necessary, but President-elect Trump, his designees for the FBI and for the Attorney General have all made it clear they have enemies lists and they want to pursue certain people, which would include people who did nothing but do a good and competent job in their roles, either as January 6th committee, as Jack Smith and his team, as members of Congress. There are a lot of people on the list, including Nancy Pelosi, who I'm hoping recovers from whatever happened in Belgium, wishing her well. And so it shouldn't be necessary, but it is. People should not be persecuted. On the other hand, if you offer someone a pardon, there may be some imputation or suggestion that they did something wrong, which these people did not do wrong, but which you can be guaranteed the Republicans will argue shows that they did. And they will use it as a way to say, as Biden did, the system of justice has been corrupted. They certainly are going to say that about releasing all the January 6th, including the violent offenders who killed people, who injured people. So there are reasons to issue it, to protect people from having to spend the next years of their lives defending themselves against spurious charges or just investigations. That alone is expensive. And as we've talked about before, we expect the private bar to step up and offer pro bono services so that they aren't going to have to pay huge legal fees. But it's still going to be their time, and it will be very disruptive of their lives. So in a way, I do think that I guess I come out, you should offer it. People will have to make their decision as to whether to accept the pardon or not.
Okay, we could talk about clemency all day, but I just want to ask you all your quick thoughts on two aspects of this, a future of requests that Biden allies are still making of him after this. One, some say, just grant every pending clemency application, just right now, just grant them all.
No.
And others say, well, how about you clear the federal death row, which means commuting all the current people sentenced to death on federal death row to life in prison without parole. Joyce was about to talk, go.
Well, I was just going to say, you've got to look at these one at a time to make sure that you're not pardoning people who present a risk of danger to the community. I've looked at a lot of pardon petitions in my life. That's the important step. You know, the category you're talking about, Kim, people on death row, there's no talk of pardons or wiping out their conviction. What would happen is their sentences would be commuted. They would no longer be death eligible. They would remain in prison for the rest of their lives. I am 100% in favor of that. And you know, I will tell you that I say that I understand how difficult that would be for victims and communities because almost exactly 35 years ago today, my father-in-law was murdered, a mail bomber, right before Christmas. The man who killed him was prosecuted and was executed. And having lived through that whole process, I am not a fan of the death penalty. And although Joe Biden can't end the death penalty with a stroke of the pen, he could make a really strong statement here. I think it would be a righteous thing for him to do.
I agree, Joyce. And he did promise in his campaign to do something about the death penalty. And this is something he can do, is by commuting the sentences. But I also agree, and I think Barbara said this too, is that we should not pardon people without looking at whether there's a chance of them reoffending and other individual factors. It's the same problem that we had with what we were talking about with the pardon of the people who were on home confinement because of COVID. Some of them deserve it and some of them don't. And so you do need a system where these requests have been pending a long time. They should be dealt with. There's a lot that needs to be done in the remaining less than 6 weeks now of the Biden presidency. And some of these are things that should be done.
What do you think, Barb?
Joyce, our hearts break for you with the death of your father-in-law. That was a really tragic case, and we're so sorry for that. On this issue, I agree with you with regard to the clemency petitions. I think you got to look at them case by case, not blanketly. And I think I'm going to push back a little bit. The three of you I know share the view that President Biden should grant clemency to the people on death row, again, you know, changing their sentence from death to life in prison. And although I agree with that as a matter of policy, I think the death penalty is barbaric. I think the government should not be in the business of killing people. I think that we, once in a while, we get it wrong, and there's no way to reverse that. I think it has a discriminatory impact on people. You see that it has, you know, disparate impact on people of color. Despite all of those things, I think the way to end the death penalty is through legislation, not through one president. I think that it is the role of Congress to change the law and for the president to simply pardon everybody or grant clemency because he disagrees with the law on this issue, I think, is something that we should require Congress to change.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
So there is a lot going on at DOJ this week. We could have spent the whole episode talking about it. I just want to pull three little threads here and share a little bit of information with our listeners. You know, this is beyond the Bondi and the Patel nominations. Really interesting stuff. First up, FBI Director Chris Wray announced he would resign by the end of the year rather than forcing Trump to fire him so he could advance Kash Patel's nomination. So, Barb, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I don't like it. You know, in some ways, it's kind of academic, right? He could either resign or he will be fired on day one. Trump has made it clear he wants to replace Christopher Wray. But I kind of feel like Wray is giving Trump an easy out to bust through a norm. The FBI director's term was set in the 1970s by Congress at 10 years. And the reason for that was twofold. One was to prevent somebody from becoming another J. Edgar Hoover and serving for, you know, 50 years or whatever it was he served. But the other was to outlast any president, even a two-term president, by giving them 10 years in office. And that was to insulate them from politics. And so if, you know, Trump already fired Comey, James Comey, when he didn't like him, and he replaced him with Wray. And now, you know, Wray presided over the investigations over Donald Trump and the search of his home. So now he doesn't like Wray either, and he's running Wray out. And so, you know, in some ways, I'm sure I don't fault Christopher Wray personally. I mean, he even gave a nice statement that he said he's doing it to kind of spare the FBI from being dragged, you know, through more political name calling and other kinds of things. But I kind of feel like if somebody's going to bust a norm here, make Trump do it. Don't make it easy for him, because I think we want the Senate to realize this is a big deal before they, you know, confirm Kash Patel or whoever else ends up being the nominee. So I kind of don't like it.
Can I just say, Barb, I take a much harder stance on this, because it's not a norm. It's a law. It's a law that passed after Watergate because the FBI was in cooperation with the government, and they wanted to keep it to be a law enforcement, not a political appointment. There used to be a joke that if you know one FBI director, you know them all. And that's because there was only one. J. Edgar Hoover founded the FBI, and he served forever. And this was to make sure that a 10-year term meant that you served under at least two presidents, that no president would have total control. They wanted to keep it from being political. So it's a law that's mm-hmm. being violated. Yeah. And he fired his first one, and now he's going to fire his second one. And that means there is no more law that says you get a 10-year non-political appointment. So I am very, very against this, and I do not think Ray should have resigned. He should have forced to be fired. He could have even fought the firing. And there should have been some political support for saying, we have a law that says 10 years and you don't even have cause. And so I'm very much against his having resigned.
Yeah, you know, I don't think he could have successfully fought the firing, because the law does permit a president to fire. Bill Clinton did it with FBI Director Sessions, who had been pilfering from the public trust. But you can come up with cause. One thing that I will say, though, is I've seen people have been referencing a David French article in the Times that suggests that there's a benefit to doing it this way. We don't really have time to parse the Vacancy Reform Act. Maybe we'll do that in another episode. I don't think that pans out. I think that this is just something that Chris Wray has done for his own personal reasons. Like you say, Barb, he's entitled to do that.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, it avoids having a larger public debate on Trump busting the norms and the laws here. But more to do, right? There's also the new nominee for DOJ's Civil Rights Division. Her name is Harmeet Dhillon. You know, the Civil Rights Division is often referred to as the crown jewel of our system of justice, and for good reason. Here we have a Trump loyalist being appointed to take that division over. Kim, what do you make of her qualifications to do the job?
Well, I'll let the listeners decide for themselves her qualifications. Up to now, her legal career has centered largely around making false claims about election fraud. Really fighting efforts to expand the availability of voting, for example, throughout the pandemic. She's done, you know, I don't want to limit her. She's done other things too. Like, she was heavily involved in challenging pandemic era restrictions in churches and elsewhere that could have, could be a spreading risk. But at that time, she did not like those or mask requirements and things like that. So, you know, she's a lawyer. What's really upsetting to me about this particular appointment, right, is one of the most important jobs of the head of the Civil Rights Division at DOJ is protecting voting rights. So you're putting in place someone whose whole claim to fame is doing the exact opposite. Right now, the person holding that spot is named Kristen Clark, and I got to know her because on leading up to elections, right down to election night, she was the one who was keeping her ear closest to the ground to make sure there were not, technical problems at the polls that were causing long waits, that there were not inadequate numbers of ballots, that there certainly that there was not any intimidation or anything else keeping people from voting on voting rights. She built her career on protecting voting rights. And this division is also responsible for doing things like enforcing our civil rights laws. And
you know, I really highly doubt someone who also is on record for casting false aspersions on DEI programs and such is going to have that in mind. So I'm not sure we will, if what I fear comes to pass, I'm not sure we will have ever seen the Civil Rights Division taking the kind of actions that are set to happen in the years ahead.
Okay, so that sounds like you're a no on her, Kim.
I'll let people make up their own minds.
Okay, last thread. Jill, this one's for you. Thursday, the DOJ Inspector General published a long overdue report on January 6th that has attracted a lot of attention. One of the central questions it considered is, and I'll quote from the report itself, how the breach had occurred and what was known by federal law enforcement in advance of January 6th about the possibility of a violent protest that day. Some people, J.D. Vance for one, are using the report to push debunked conspiracy theories. What do you make of the report, its timing, and the conclusions it reaches?
So before I answer this really important and good question, I just want to add to what Kim said, because I think the Civil Rights Division is to protect the rights of minorities. And this person who is nominated protects the rights of majorities. She's made that clear in everything that she has done in court. So I would join Kim in being a no. As to the Inspector General's report, which took 4 years, I mean, it's now 4 years after January 6th, and we are just getting to this report. There are two different things. One is how the breach occurred, which is clear that there was some miscommunications. And this is something that has happened in many, many circumstances. When I was general counsel of the Army, we had a problem with interoperability of communication systems so that our boats, ships, tankers could not pull up in European places because we don't use the metric system. We have all seen what happens when you can't communicate on walkie-talkies because you're on different channels. So that's one of the things about how the breach occurred, and they make some recommendations on how to improve it. But they point out that out of the hundreds of thousands, maybe not hundreds of thousands, but out of the many confidential sources that the FBI uses, there were 26 in D.C. on that day, only three of whom actually entered the Capitol, and none of whom were authorized to do so by their handlers at the FBI. There is absolutely a clear, conclusion that the FBI is not the cause of January 6th, that there was no encouragement or participation in the bad acts that happened. And so it's surprising to me that J.D. Vance or anyone else, and he's not alone, there are many others who are using this to push debunked conspiracy theories. And it's a shame. People should read this report, or at least the summaries of the report, to see that it absolutely says there was no FBI involvement in this event on January 6th. So please take away the facts of this, which is that it does not. It debunks the conspiracy theories. It doesn't help them.
You know, we are all lawyers by nature. We are DOJ watchers, but I suspect we will be doing even a more tightly focused DOJ watch for the next 4 years than we have up until now. So this is something that we'll commit to you, that will help you stay informed on.
This brings us to our favorite part of the show, which is to answer your questions. And if you have a question for us, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us on social media using #sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your question today during the show, keep an eye on our feeds throughout the week, because we sometimes answer the other questions that we didn't get to. And we love hearing from you. Our first question today comes from Stephanie in Cleveland, Ohio, and I think this is a great question for you, Kim. Is anyone legitimately investigating the elections results? It seems that neither side trusts them. How can we fix that?
Okay, so the first part of the question is, yes, the election results have been very, very well vetted. So here's what happens, because I've seen a lot of questions like this since the election, sort of saying, well, how can we trust the results and that there was no funny business. First, it remains the case that widespread voter fraud in an election, a presidential election, is very, very difficult to impossible. It's really hard. They're done locally and statewide before you even get to the federal level. Everybody has their own systems. Really, really hard nut to crack in that way. Second of all, the DOJ is always watching. They have their own election unit to ensure that there isn't any shenanigans. And when they are reported, they are investigated. Not to mention the fact that there are several legal organizations like the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which Kristen Clark used to lead, which is why she was the person I would call on election night to find out if there was any reported shenanigans, because she knew. You have the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And this year on Kamala Harris's own team was the Mark Elias, who knows if anybody is thinking of even walking up to a voting place in the wrong way, like some signal goes off in Mark's head and he is on it investigating it and ensuring that people's votes are protected. So all those factors together make clear that there were no widespread shenanigans in 2024 like there weren't in 2020. Why don't people trust the election? That's because people spread disinformation about fraud, including the incoming president. That's why. And that's a much more difficult problem to solve. People don't always take the time to look at all the many ways. I left out automatic recounts in districts and counties and states where there were the elections within like 2%. Automatically, there are recounts, and there were several automatic recounts in this election. And the results are the same. So, I mean, these are all the safeguards that are in place. People lie about them. And then when people don't have trust in election results, then Republicans usually are the ones that say, well, you know what, we need to build more trust in our elections. So we're going to go pass all of these election restrictions. And those election restrictions make it even harder for people to get to the polls, result in even more delays and problems. And then again, people distrust it more. So it's a mess. It's very hard to fix. But long and short, this election was not fraudulent.
Yeah, it is hard to fix, especially when the president-elect still will not admit that he lost the 2020 election fair and square. He insisted on Kristen Welker to her on Meet the Press that he wouldn't admit that that was true. So that's really too bad. Our next question comes from Fred, and it's for Barb. Would the speech and debate clause protect members of the January 6th committee and their staff from threats made by Donald Trump and Kash Patel?
Ooh, Fred, very astute. I think you're on to something. I'm going to give you a yes, but to that. So the speech or debate clause comes from Article 1 of the Constitution, which of course sets forth the powers of Congress. And it says that they should, members of Congress, senators and representatives, shall be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session in their respective houses. And for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any place. And it has been largely interpreted to mean that anything a member of Congress does in their capacity as someone who is focusing on either legislation or investigation in their role as a member of Congress is insulated, and it's been extended to their staffs. So as you say, I think they would have a very strong defense against a charge that might be filed against them. Now, that's the yes part. Here's the but. I think that it would not stop the FBI under Kash Patel or the Attorney General under Pam Bondi or whoever it ends up being, could still initiate an investigation and make their lives miserable. So say you're Liz Cheney. There's nothing that is sort of an affirmative defense she would have to assert after being charged. And so even though it would be a bad faith investigation and prosecution, I think that she could still find herself the target of an investigation, which of course would bring with it, you know, legal costs, aggravation, harm to her reputation, emotional distress, and a lot of other things. So I'll give you, Fred, a yes, but.
Good answer, Barb. And our last question for today comes from Thalia. And I'm going to ask you to answer this, Joyce. Would any of you ever considering running for office? I guess all of us have to answer that.
You know, I'm going to give a different answer than I would have given a year ago or really even 3 months ago. I mean, I am married to an elected official. My husband was a state court judge for 20 years. I watched him run. I even sometimes grudgingly accompanied him on campaign events. But he also ran twice for statewide office. Some of you may recall an Alabama politician named Roy Moore, our former chief justice, who lost to Doug Jones when Doug Jones became a U.S. senator, when during that race, allegations that he was interested in having sexual relationships with underage women surfaced. And my sweet husband, Bob, actually lost to him for that Supreme Court race before those allegations surfaced. So I just say that to say I've seen how annoying and difficult and horrible it is to run, especially when you're in the minority party in a one-party rule state. But I think we live in times that call all of us to step outside of our comfort zones and to give more than we're willing to give.
Are you making an announcement, Joyce?
I'm not making an announcement because, look, I am a Jewish girl from the left coast in deep red Alabama. But, I mean, I wouldn't rule out maybe serving on an advisory board or maybe running in my county, which is maybe more blue. But what I do think we all need to do is ask ourselves where we can serve. And I would certainly want to help people with better outlooks than mine might be to run, good candidates to run, and be more engaged in that process than I might have expected myself to be at this point in my life.
Barb, you want to give a
quick? Well, that's a pretty good answer. I'm going to give, can I also be a left coast Jewish girl in the deep red South? Because I like that answer.
Most
we are the same
are.
Person, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Whatever,
Joyce. You look like one, but I don't think you'll get away with it. And Kim, what about you?
Nope, 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 nobody, nope, 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 never. We'll never run for office. Nope. No desire. Don't want to do it. Would never do it. No, thank you.
I actually did run for office. It was not exactly the office I think that this question is about, but it was as a Biden delegate in 2020. And I actually enjoyed the process a lot, meeting people and going out and getting petitions signed. And so, you know, if I was 20 years younger, 30 years younger, I might consider it because I now feel called to serve in a way that I never did because I think so much is at stake now. And I think it's important, as Joyce said, for all of us to consider how we can best serve, whether it's on your local library board to make sure that books aren't banned, your school board, or at a state or federal level. I think it's important. Maybe it's just contributing, holding a house party to meet the candidates. I think there are ways we can all contribute to make sure that we preserve our democracy. Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Joyce Vance, Kimberly Atkins-Store, Barb McQuaid, and me, Jill Wine Banks. Please follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. And please show some love to this week's sponsors, Osea Malibu, Blue Land, and Thrive Cosmetics. Their links are in the show notes, and they really help us to make this podcast possible, so please support them. See you next week with another episode, Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. Brisby and I and Michael had a photo shoot on Monday, and we brought with our dog trainer, who brought with sound effects, cat calls, dog barks. He brought toys and balls, and none of it worked. He was not cooperative. He wouldn't, I mean, if he doesn't put his ears in a normal place, he flattens his ears and he looks like he's wearing a babushka. I mean, it's
awesome. Well, that's because you didn't run it by his agent first. Like, Brisby knows what's
silent protest.
Brisby
good
was
protest.
Like, these look, pictures are not authorized.
I don't know if you can see, but Bella is sulking behind me because I would not let her play with the furniture delivery guys, and she is pissed.
I don't blame her.
Vengeful pets. I love it.
She is really pissed.
Vengeful pets.
She won't even look at me.
Oh.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.